The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, and a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine on this Wednesday. It's the 5th of August. How you all keeping? As we mentioned just before the news there, it's unseasonably windy, we're being told, with rain. But sure, look it. When you wake up, that's all good, isn't it? Listen, we've a busy show lined up for you over the next 2 hours. Please stick around. Lots coming up, and we want you involved in the conversation throughout. I'm going to give you a reminder of how you get in touch with us. If you want to give us a call, we still love your phone calls, 07491 25000. Caroline, or the researcher and producer of this programme, taking your calls, assisted by Shannon. You can WhatsApp and text us on 086 60 25000. Don't forget, you can send your WhatsApp voice messages to that number too. Or you can email comments at highlandradio.com. The option there is to watch the show. You can watch us on the YouTube app, on your smart TV, your Fire Stick, or your mobile devices. Just type in Highland Radio. And we're across Facebook and on the X platform. So wherever you go, it's hard to escape us, and that's what we like. Right, let's have a look at the newspapers, because we've a lot coming up, a lot to squeeze in. And we'll go with the Finn Valley Voice. It's out today. As of the end of last June, just 44 people were homeless in Donegal, set against the national homeless figure of 11,862. It works out at 0.37% of Ireland's total. You are 8 times more likely to be homeless elsewhere in Ireland than you are in Donegal. But of course, those figures don't tell the full picture. Because there's lots of different scenarios whereby you might not be classed as homeless, but you effectively are homeless. And there's a deep dive into those figures. You can check it out in today's Finn Valley Voice. I'm not sure if this story is going to impact on people in this part of the world. I suspect it might, and it comes from the Irish Times. The names of 341 former Christian Brothers who are being joined as defendants to a case where a man who was sexually abused in primary school in the 1970s is suing the congregation. They've been published in a national newspaper. The men on the list, who were all Christian Brothers between September 1974 and December 1979, are not alleged to have anything to do with the sexual assault, but find themselves being joined to the case because of the controversial legal strategy being adopted by the congregation. The litigant is suing the Christian Brothers for abuse he suffered when attending CBS school in Stephen Street, Kilkenny, where he was sexually assaulted by former brother Liam Coughlin. So all of these names have been published in the newspaper. They were at the weekend, and no suggestion in the publication of the names of impropriety, but it's similar to, I don't know if you've ever watched the documentary The Keepers. It's a United States focused in Baltimore, effectively, whereby allegations of sexual abuse by two women, Jane Doe and Jane Roe, I think it was, that were taking a case against the Catholic Church, as it was at that time. And then they took out newspaper articles saying, look, were you in this school between 68 and 74 or whatever the years were? And then hundreds of primarily girls came forward, and the case was built from there. This is somewhat different in that the names have been put out there first, but there certainly are going to be names on that list where they taught in Donegal schools. Whether or not there was any impropriety, we simply don't know. But have you seen that list? Did you check for names? You know, is this something that you've been waiting for? Was this a moment whereby, well, maybe something happened to me, I'm now included and I can move forward with this? I don't know. Maybe you were affected that way. If you were, and maybe you want to let us know, 086 60 25000. But as I say, all those names published, very unusual, but apparently it's the way the congregation is defending it, that it had to be done that way. Big pressure on people at the moment with bills, and I hate to see people falling into arrears on things like electricity, home heating, or particularly at this time of year, because we are using less electricity, generally speaking. It depends on how your home's set up, but you know, the brighter evenings, we generally use less electricity. For the most part, I think we generally use less home heating oil. We don't know how many people are struggling to pay for home heating oil, but we know how many people are struggling to pay for electricity. And a record number of families are now in electricity arrears, owing a combined $165 million, it was revealed yesterday. The mountain of cash is owed by more than 322,000 households, with the average debt of €511 each. Official figures from the Commission for the Regulation of Utilities show. Now, I'm not sure if you've ever been in a situation where you've got a bill like that hanging over your head and it's very hard to pay. I know exactly how that feels, and you can feel really, really trapped under the weight of it, because you've got this bill, and that means that any spare cash you have going forward would need to go towards that bill to keep the lights on, quite literally. And €511 when you are struggling to make ends meet is a huge amount of money and puts huge pressure on. And I would say if these figures don't include pay as you go, and I'll read through and we'll find out, that is going to be another cohort of people under pressure. The number of homes behind on their gas bills has also ballooned to near record highs. Doesn't affect us as much up here, the gas side of things. Sinn Féin MEP Lynn Boylan blamed the crippling debts on the government's lack of support for households, calling for energy-hungry data centres to contribute more. She accused the government of axing energy credits while its approach to big business was sharing them with new subsidies and not discounts. It doesn't tell the full story. I know where the MEP is coming from. It's kind of a popular, it kind of is a popular approach, but it doesn't really dig into the nitty-gritty if you did something like that. But anyway, she's calling on the government to look at that. Again, if you want to give us an insight into living under the burden of a bill like that, please let us know. Speaking of electricity, electric vehicles have reached a tipping point in Ireland after becoming the country's most popular type of new car for the first time, new industry figures show. Society of Irish Motor Industry figures show battery electric vehicles account for 26.12% of all new cars registered this year. And what's interesting about that is, for a while, they kind of grouped hybrid and electric cars in, and I think it was to sort of show an exaggerated trend, but these are fully electric cars, which is really quite remarkable. And they have just overtaken petrol electric hybrids at 24.9%. A total of 29,480 new electric cars have been registered so far this year, up 61% in fact, in the same period of 2025. So it's happening. And we're well behind some of the Nordic countries, whereby the electric car sales account for like 98%. I think in Norway or Sweden, I always get them mixed up. But anyway, there you go. For the first time ever in this little old country of ours, electric vehicles are the most popular full electric vehicles, that is. The Health and Safety Authority have sent their file on the Chrysler tragedy to the Director of Public Prosecutions. For families, this is a major milestone, and I'm taking this from The Sun today. The move now opens the way for the DPP to complete its investigation into the tragedy. So that was the last piece of the puzzle, I beg your pardon, before the DPP can begin to decide where this case goes. Files from the Gardaí and the Commission for Regulation of Utilities have already been submitted to the DPP. Donna Harper, mother of the late Leona Harper, who was just 14 when she died in the tragedy, said the DPP hopefully now has all the information and we can press forward. We have been waiting for 4 years for all files to be completed. If things move at a proper pace from now, I think on reflection, the time taken might seem okay given the complex nature of the investigation if it progresses with speed and pace and accuracy from here forward. But the DPP, I don't know how long it will take, but we'll keep an eye on that, of course. I always struggle to figure out how, when we have it tough, the companies that we pay the most money to make most money. So oil, right? So, you know, we've got the situation where the Strait of Hormuz has been closed. Oil supply has been restricted. So oil prices go up, right? And you would think it's because, you know, the oil companies can't get the oil, and fair play to them. They're getting us a few bits and bobs, and we need to send them a few quid extra, right? Obviously, that's not the case, and I'm being a bit facetious there. They're just making more and more money off our backs, it has to be said. So in other words, when there is an oil crisis, the oil companies make more money and we make less. It's the same with other things as well. We see it all the time, don't we? Petrol and diesel, even in this country. So big oil companies are continuing to book massive profits as the fighting in Iran disrupts emerging markets and sends oil and petrol prices sharply higher. So, like, when oil gets too cheap, they turn the pipes off really effectively, or they have to up until now. I mean, you have to be a conspiracy theorist to sort of say a situation whereby maybe those in the industry could be egging Iran on. You know, the more Iran disrupts, the more it agitates, the more money they make. And is that not really going to drive immoral behavior? I talk about being a conspiracy theorist. You almost have to be naive not to believe something like that is happening. So the longer this rumbles on, the more money the biggest companies in the world are making. So six of Europe's largest oil firms posted combined first quarter profits of 19 billion, more than 40% higher than last year. Profits of BP more than doubled to 3.4 billion in the second quarter, the company has said. That's only a quarter, as the conflict has dragged on. High oil prices have driven up the cost of petrol, jet fuel and diesel, which has led to higher shipping costs. And yet the oil companies continue to make loads of money. I wonder how many of you have booked accommodation or are going up for a day trip to Belfast, because it's a very historic event. The first Fláth Chéanna Héireann to ever take place in Belfast has seen a 95% footfall increase in the city. And I was speaking to some people from Belfast at the weekend, and they were so excited for what's going on up there. The celebration of Irish music and culture officially opened on Sunday in the North's capital, and is also it also saw a trial of extended opening hours for shops. It's set to go on until Sunday with more than 200 events and 180 traditional music competitions at venues, pubs and streets, projected to bring some 800,000 people to Belfast. And there's a lot going on. Old factories have been repurposed for gigs and all that type of stuff. And by all accounts, I think they have it next year too, don't they? By all accounts, it's going to be a cracker if that is your thing. I'm sure there's lots of people going up to visit as much as to... going up to perform as much as to visit. It's great to see so many people from within the county out and about, and those visiting the county and enjoying themselves and spending their money and enjoying everything the county has to offer. And listen, we're second to none in terms of our coastlines. But unfortunately, there is still an abuse of these spaces. And this, you know, people might go, well, what do you mean? But if you don't live near it, or if you don't understand the complications of it, maybe that you don't get it. But our piers, slipways and berths need to be kept clear for obvious reasons. Reasons we'll tease out right now. But unfortunately, we're having life-saving services, Mulroy Coast Guard, Aranmore RNLI and others, having to put out warnings there because of constant abuse. So we want to drive home that message with the Mayor of Letterkenny, Milford Municipal District, Fianna Fáil Councillor Park McGarvey. Good morning, Park.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning to your listeners.
And listen, as I say, ignorance isn't a defence, right? But I don't think sometimes people realise when they pull the car into these yellow boxes or block entrances or what have you, the fact that what they're doing could literally cost lives.
Exactly, Greg. And I suppose we're back talking again about the same issue that's been going on for years and years. And Downings and Rathmullen, Port Salon, but I suppose in Downings in particular, where the Mulroy Coast Guard have to launch their boat, an emergency. We've seen it the weekend again, unauthorised and I suppose unresponsible parking again at the slipway, and ignorance of the yellow boxes and the signage there that has in place.
Yeah, because sometimes I would say, listen, we need to give motorists a chance. We need to make sure that they know you can do this or you can't do that. There's no excuses here. The signage is very clear. The boxing is very, very clear. It's designed really quite specifically for obviously general use, but to accommodate the launching of the life raft.
Exactly. And I suppose there is minimal parking there, but I think there's about 13 spaces and a disabled parking space. But This is critical. It's ongoing, and I suppose I touched base with the council yesterday morning following calls over the weekend, and the council agreed that it needed to be reviewed. So I'm looking at setting up a meeting now with the council and the relevant stakeholders, I suppose Mulroy Coast Guard and the fishermen and all and down into there. So we hope that a resolution can come to have the slipway kept clear. And I did propose a possibility of an access barrier. So he didn't rule it out. And
what would be the function of that?
Well, I suppose it would leave that only personnel that's able to get onto the pier would be able to access it. You know, a key code or a just a simple barrier or something light, nothing too heavy, but it would stop people driving onto the slipway and blocking it up.
You mean the car park?
Yeah, the small car park there, yeah. Yeah.
So you would leave the, you would limit access to that? Well,
well, it's only a proposal, I suppose.
I don't think it's a good one, to be honest with you. So, but if people are launching their boats, how would they be able to do that?
Yeah, well, I suppose hopefully that there could be somebody there that would be able to allow access to the pier.
But sure, some people go down fishing at 6:30 in the morning. That's completely unworkable as far as I can see. But as you say, listen, something has to be done. Sorry, I don't want to sound like I'm piling on the idea. It's just
Look, there's so many things has to be discussed here, and this just can't happen on a bank holiday weekend or a busy weekend. You know, so we just want to look at the options and what options is available.
I think what we need to do, say, for instance, just using that area as an example, the decision was made to block traffic off that beach for the bank holiday weekend, broadly welcomed, but you couldn't get down onto the beach with a pram. Or if someone had a wheelchair, you couldn't get down onto the beach. So, you know, when people are coming up with their ideas, I think really they need to actually think them through fully. You know what I mean? Rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That barrier was put up down there without the possibility of someone in a wheelchair or someone pushing a pram to get onto the beach. Doesn't make a great deal of sense, does it?
Well, yeah, I understand that. But I suppose there is changes happening in Downings, and there's new changing facilities, a new promenade there and a bit of parking. So I suppose there is going to be things changing and happening in the Downings, and I suppose we have to work with the changes. I suppose we didn't want the same thing happening as happened there the last rally weekend. So that's why they...
I think enforcement park is a big one, and that comes down to resources, and I get that, don't get me wrong, but... You know, a few fines.
Greg, we know too well, Greg. The Gardaí, I actually was speaking to the guards yesterday as well, and they have numerous fines going out to people who was parked on the pier. So they were doing their job as well.
And it comes down to personal responsibility. And I'll just mention the situation at Aaron Moore, if you don't mind, Parg. I'll hold you there.
No problem.
Because the crew and OPP teams are asking all boat users to keep the lifeboat berth at the ferry pier on Aaron Moore free for emergencies. They ask for consideration on this as it's interfering with medical evacuations from the island. Many of these medical evacuations are time sensitive, and patient welfare is one of our main priorities when transferring to Burton Port. And I think, ironically, as we talk about this, I think Mulroy were out twice from that pier that you're talking of in the one day, one in the early hours and later. So it's just imperative that people don't park their Porrig. And conversations, you say, are ongoing to ensure safe access, whatever that might be.
Look, we're open to options, and I suppose the relevant stakeholders, the Mulroy Coast Guard and all, being involved. So I suppose, look, as you said, Greg, there, the Mulroy Coast Guard were called out at 4 a.m. I think on Sunday morning, and that could have been a different story if it was 4 p.m. you know, with the parking. So look, it has to be reviewed, it has to be looked at, and more infrastructure has to be put on there too.
I think people local to these areas know what's going on. It's just a case of maybe people that some people feel a bit entitled, I think, wherever they might be.
Well, that's what I was going to say, entitled, and maybe on just unsure of the area as well. But yellow boxes, you wouldn't drive into Letterkenny and park in a yellow box.
No.
You know, so Brendan's no different.
Exactly. You see, we've just referenced what's happening there with on the West Coast. Rathmullen, I think you mentioned as well. Donegal Town's got its ongoing issues with parking down by the pier there. It's just right across the county. We have to figure out what's what and what the right thing to do is. All right, Parik, I think really the purpose of what we're saying is of course, whatever ideas might be implemented, that's all well and good. Ultimately, we need people to respect the yellow boxes, no double parking, and understand that a very big tractor towing a very big boat needs to get into that water in seconds. And they can do that if they're not obscured. Okay, brilliant stuff.
Exactly. And just to mention, Greg, yes. I think the Mulroy Coast Guard has a very strong video on their social media, and I think it's something that just shows you the impact and the importance of keeping the road clear for them to get down there.
Okay, well, if we haven't shared that, we'll share that already, because you're quite right there, Parik. Listen, thanks very much indeed, Councillor Parik McGarvey there. I saw an interesting article in the Irish Independent. By the way, if you want to talk about that, 086 60 25,000, an interesting article in the Irish Independent. It's more of a feature piece, and it's about grandparents avoiding babysitting burnout. And I wonder, is this relevant to you? The summer holidays can be a great excuse to spend more time with the grandchildren, but exhaustion can quickly creep up on you and make a sudden shift into full-time childcare mode. Carving out some time for yourself is crucial for your well-being, so navigating childcare during the summer break can sometimes be a tricky balancing act. And the newspaper has spoken to an expert in relation to this about how you can manage how much time you spend babysitting your grandchildren. Now, I would imagine that if they're of a certain age, a lot of them, your grandkids might have been at summer camps or what have you, but there is a period, of course, where those staff there need a break. And I wonder, have you kind of become a full-time parent again, doing the best thing for your kids, don't get me wrong, in looking after their kids so they can work and pay the bills, but maybe eating into your ability to get away or your ability to recharge your batteries? Is that something you want to tell us on the QT, WhatsApp or text? Have you become sort of overwhelmed with babysitting responsibilities in this new Ireland that we live in now, when ordinarily you might have been thinking that, you know, it's nice to have them over for the weekend, and it's nice also to not have them over the weekend at times? But I feel, whilst I kind of giggle at the way I'm proposing it, that this potentially for some people out there can be quite straining. It can be quite difficult, that you feel under pressure, you feel that you have to do this, and it's eating up into your time and your well-being. There are others too that it's fantastic that they get to spend more time with their grandchildren, but I wonder, is it something you want to talk about? You can WhatsApp or text us on 086 60 25,000. A caller says, Greg, the ESB has given its chief executive, Paddy Hayes, a pay increase of just under €92,000 after receiving ministerial approval to do so. All this while families struggle to pay their bills. It's ridiculous. And I spotted that in the papers, but I didn't want to really pee everyone off so much. I thought, if I say that, people are going to be absolutely fuming. I was going to say it a little bit later on. ESB has given CEO a pay rise 29%, bringing his pay to €410,000. It's crazy money, isn't it? A lot of you vexed by that. A caller says, we're spending all our money on Ukrainians and housing Somalians, and our Help to Buy scheme is being used by other nationalities. No wonder we've no money left to pay our own electricity bills. I get where you're coming from. I understand that you might have frustrations there, and I'm not saying it's not the case, but I assure you, the reason the ESB boss has got a 92k pay rise, and the reason why over 300,000 families are struggling to pay their bills, it's because people have decided not to help them. It's got nothing to do with the help for Ukrainians or Somalians or whomever it might be. And as I say, I'm not saying your concerns there are wrong, but trust, there's plenty of money about if there is the will to do something about it. Rightio, let's go to Parik. Yesterday on the show, Donna Marie, oh, by the way, thanks, Donna Marie, for sitting in for me. Yesterday on the show, we were talking about a shop that had I think I saw some of this story. They have an annual fee to pay, and they decided to sell cigarettes, and they decided that it wasn't worth it. They're not going to pay that fee. Therefore, it's going to be a shop not selling cigarettes. And there's another shop opened not so long ago that doesn't sell newspapers, believe it or not. So I don't think we're too far away whereby you know, your local news agents will sell neither ciggies nor newspapers. But anyway, Parik, we're going to follow up on the cigarette situation. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, good, good. So what's your reaction to, I suspect, the first of many shops making this call?
Yeah, well, I suppose like the overheads to have this commodity in their store is always a cost as well. But what I'd be saying is, you know, I suppose really there's a €1,000 fee to stock cigarettes. Obviously, the margin and markup is very low. There's something max of a 10% profit there. But right. Like when you take it all into consideration, you know, 10%, that's 10% net. Obviously, that's gross. But then to take your wages, your credit card. So if somebody comes in to purchase a packet of cigarettes and they might pay by credit card, that's eaten into your cost. So obviously, there's certain commodities within a shop that margins are quite low. And, you know, sometimes I suppose I've worked in retail myself for many years, and, you know, I always heard the feedback from people saying, you know, it's handy to have a small shop there for the milk and bread. But unfortunately for the margin there as well, as we know it in the terms of retail, a KVI, which is a known valued item, you're not going to be charging any extra to try and build up your margins.
Yeah.
Obviously, so it's like everything. Businesses has a lot of cost, and you know, the importance to society and within the community, your local shop is something that we need to keep opened, and let that be, you know, it's not for only bread and milk, but there's other products there as well, because it's like every store, you walk into a store, there's special offers, there's special offers in every store. So maybe some people think, oh, I must go to the bigger store and do my shopping, and obviously forget about the smaller store and say, oh, you know what, we'll nip over there and we'll get a liter of milk or we'll get a loaf of bread. But unfortunately, the margins are so low. And then, like, it's like everything, you need to man it. You need to have your staffing in, and that's costing as well. So it's a very important thing to, you know, I just think that maybe a lot of fees are put on businesses, and they don't put any thought into it, you know, for making, for them to survive, you know.
I think, and I don't know much about retail, but it's more of observation, Park. I think your Wee shop, the numbers might be up for them. I think really what shops are having to do to survive now is invest, have to sell ice cream, have to maybe even have a small deli, you know. And I would say they're doing that to try and get in store stuff you can actually make money with and to absorb some of the costs you talk of. I think really, you know, that Wee shop that just sells the essentials, maybe some sweets and all that type of stuff, sadly might become a thing of the past, you know, as maybe the owner of that retires, because they can't be making a fortune.
No, that's correct, Greg, you know. And when you branch into other franchise within the business for like a hot deli, as you just said,
coffee machine,
that
maybe,
all comes at a cost as well. Yeah, coffee machine. It's all about volume. So you need to have volume going through. So good footfall would be a major thing for that. But obviously, you know, all of those things come at a cost. But, you know, it's all about supporting. I suppose the main message I would be putting out there is people to think twice, because if their local shop closes within their own community, you know, it's not every day you will be beside a multi-store or one of the bigger stores,
yeah.
Because, you know, it's important that you support. Community is a big thing in every society. And like listening in there, and I was following Sinead Black there on Clonmany and different events, like, all that's community, and it's all revolved around the community. And obviously, like ourselves now, in the little village here of Ardra, we have the Ardra shows coming up. That there is something that all the retailers hopefully will make some extra money, and that will help them through the quieter months as well, you know.
Parik, when is the Ardra show coming up? When is it?
The Ardra show is... It's on the 8th of August, which is next Saturday.
Brilliant.
And then we have a second day. Yeah.
I was going to say, what's lined?
We have a second day then on the 15th.
Do you know what's lined up? What's happening on Saturday?
Well, on the first day, obviously, there's all different things relating to home baking. There's plants. There's a whole array of stuff there which people will enjoy. There's just everything there in store for, and it's a great venue there too at the Ard Naraha Pierce Memorial Park in Ardraa, which a lot of work and people as a community all come and give their time voluntary. So that shows what it's all about, to keep in the community and keeping your local shop open, you know.
Yeah, that's the 8th. Did you say there was a second day? I'm not putting you on the spot, Parry, but listen, wouldn't it be crazy if we didn't
get there's the second day. Yeah, no, there's the second day then on the 15th, which is an open day for horses and different things. Before this, they would have run the two in within the one day, but then obviously people to see it all, obviously too much was pushed in. So obviously now on the 15th, there will be a second day of horse and pony and hens, different things in general relating to the agricultural show, you know. So it's going to be a very interesting time, you know.
It is a beautiful part of the world at the worst of times, so it's extra beautiful at the best of times. Okay, listen, Parik, I get where you're coming from, and people are texting in along what you're saying on Facebook. The corner shop is a valued part of the community. Sorry, that's on YouTube, and needs to be supported. And yes, it does. The cigarettes one is an interesting one, because whilst they are legal, you know, if my mother was still alive today, she'd be on the phone now giving out about cigarettes not being available. That's just the fact of the matter.
Yeah.
Because that's just the way she was. Not an advocate of it, but the rights of people. You know, I'm thinking it's popular to sort of say a post office is closing. What about older people getting their pension? But, you know, if people still choose to smoke or they can't get off them, where are they going to go to get their cigarettes? They can feel quite isolated. And as a former smoker, thankfully not for a long time, that would cause quite a lot of stress and anxiety.
So.
Yeah. All right, Parik, look after yourself. Mm. Enjoy Ardraa. So there's two shows, the 8th and the 15th. We'll get more information and I'll give it a further plug closer to the time, because we're part of the community too. We have to support the community, and it's a self-supporting environment. Thank you very much indeed. And speaking of... we were down in Dunlow for the Mary from Dunlow International Arts Festival. It seems like it's finished now, weeks ago. You take a Tuesday of a bank holiday weekend off, and you come in and it feels like you haven't worked for months. But just a big congratulations to Gavin and Pat for putting on a fantastic 10 days. In excess of 60,000 people visited, an additional 60,000 people visited Dunlow. Everyone had a great time. Huge congratulations to the London Mary, Eva, who's now the Mary from Dunlow. Beautiful girl. But I'll tell you one thing, all of those women, powerful women. If you didn't watch that show, by the way, it's available on their Facebook page. It's a good wee watch. And Daniel O'Donnell, you know, he explains it himself about how he's just a local support in the festival, and he's very good at what he does, but there are other people putting up stages and directing traffic that are very good at what they do. And all of them are equally important. And it's true. It's true. But it's just, for someone with his stature to be so modest, it's quite impressive. And there seems to be great crack going on all over the county now as well, too, with these brilliant festivals and events that are happening. Clonmany, of course, going super strong. Right, just before a break, I want to let you know that very shortly we're going to start pulling tickets for our €20,000 Mega Summer Draw. It is back and it's always popular. So we've got $20,000 total in cash to give away this summer. And it's in six chances. Five chances of $2,000, which is lovely, isn't it? And then the overall, the grand prize then is €10,000. So the draws take place Friday week. So the first draw takes place Friday the 14th of August, and then we'll have draws every Friday after that, with the final draw then on this show on the 4th of September, though my name seems to have been omitted from that now. The show should... Caroline, would you speak to the higher-ups here, please? Yeah. I'm only joking. I think it is, unless they've changed their minds. I don't know. But anyway, normally it is. Tickets €15, and you can get them for a tenner as well. So you can get them 5 for €50. Every ticket is entered into all six draws. And again, and I'll reiterate this because it's important to me, that there are huge draws out there, and fair play to them, and they cover the entire country and beyond. And sometimes it can be as hard as winning the lotto as winning some of those draws. But this is primarily, every winner has been from Donegal. Every winner has been a listener to Highland Radio. This is for us, and the odds are greatly reduced. Right, but it is, it's a punt, and please only do so if you have the spare cash and can have a bit of fun with it. So tickets are €15, 5 for 50. The first draw is Friday week. And I'm mentioning it now because you can get online and buy your tickets, and then you're in on all six draws. You know, you can even forget that you've entered and win 10 grand next month. Who's to say? So our website, highlandradio.com, you can buy your tickets there. Give us a call, 07491 25000, or indeed, if you prefer, you can call into us here at the radio station. But as I say, get them now, park it, then you can forget about it, and you're in all of the draws. Just remember, you don't have to answer your phone. So if you work in an office or in retail and your phone is tied up during the day, that doesn't matter. You don't have to answer your phone. You don't have to answer within a certain amount of rings. You actually just... your ticket is your win, and you've won, right? Christy Galligan is a former Garda sergeant. He joins me on the programme now. Christy, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Greg, for having me on.
We have ourselves in the unenviable situation whereby we've really never spent more money on trying to get a road safety message out there. But at the same time, unfortunately, we're starting to see an increase in those that are dying on our roads. Is it a case of more traffic without the improvement of infrastructure, more people on the roads in different ways, or are we getting the road safety message wrong?
I think it's a combination of all, because unfortunately since 2021 we had 50,000 drivers arrested for drunk driving, over 1 million for speeding notices. This weekend alone, the bank holiday, we had 4,400 caught speeding again, 160 for intoxicated driving, and 370 people no seatbelts and caught using a mobile phone. Then we have the problems of uninsured drivers or disqualified drivers on our roads. There are so many variables that you can attach to our road safety. I wouldn't call it safety at the present moment. Our numbers have gone up. 110 people have died on our roads. You have thousands that are injured as a result of these accidents. And unfortunately, no matter... it seems no matter what programs the government take out or road safety authority takes out, the big problem is the lack of investment in our road enforcement and road policing unit. And I don't think there's sufficient numbers in the roads policing units to enforce road safety strategies. Now, it's all very well to have bank holiday weekends, as we always see. There's big photo ops and photo shoots in relation to the numbers got at bank holiday weekends. But remember, there's 365 days in the year, and they're not all bank holidays. And unfortunately, unless you have consistent road traffic enforcement right across all aspects of or all roads in our country.
But Christy,
then,
just
you know,
in
you're
reality, you know, you've been on the ground. How does that look in Donegal? Paint a picture for me when you talk about the way policing should be, because I'm not really sure we could ever have enough Gardaí to do what you're talking of or what people might want, sadly. But describe to me roads policing in Donegal in an ideal situation, rather than us sort of, you know, a blanket statement. So what do you think the Donegal roads would look like in terms of policing that you believe would have a positive impact in reducing injuries and death?
Prior to the policing reforms that we introduced in this country and the reduction in the numbers of Gardaí, we had a large road traffic corps here in Letterkenny. Based out of Letterkenny, it was a divisional traffic corps that covered a good part of this county. You had a large numbers on those units, and you know, you might have two or three sergeants, maybe 12 Gardaí or more, and they went all to all arts and parts of the country. Now that has been reduced dramatically. We know that the numbers of Gardaí in Donegal has reduced over the last decade by about 30 to 40 in number. And really, with the thousands of kilometres roads, with extra people driving on the roads, increasing population, you have to keep up with that. You know,
what numbers would it look like, Christy? What would it look like, though? You've mentioned the resources that would be there, but what would policing look like if returned to those resources or even increased? Where would the guards be? How would they be enforcing what?
Yeah, but you know, if we were to return to what we had as a road policing unit, as the Garda Traffic Corps, as it was known, each and every day, those traffic corps members were sent out in all hours and parts of this and doing all of the checkpoints. You would see checkpoints everywhere. I mean, it's not too long ago, when 10 or 15 years ago, when you saw checkpoints right, left and centre, by not only by traffic corps members, but by Garda members themselves. And unfortunately, you don't see as much of that enforcement now as you did 10 to 15 years ago.
So we'd have more checkpoints, and hopefully then we'd identify more drink and drug driving. We have technology now to identify uninsured vehicles, but it would pick up some of that as well too, right? So then what else? Because, you know, I don't want to be disrespectful, but there's no time whereby you can talk about road traffic collisions without it feeling like it's too soon. But a lot of the collisions we're looking at are on roads with 60-kilometre speed limits, 80-kilometre speed limits, not the main arteries. You know, there would never be a checkpoint no matter how many guards you have on them. So beyond that, what do we do then?
Well, I mean, it comes back down to education. And apart from enforcement, it comes down to education as well. And I think the problem here is that I don't think that when you come to road traffic enforcement, and I've been to the courts many times over the years where you saw people who were disqualified 2, 3, 4, 5 times, and there's no punitive sanctions. And I talk about imprisonment here as a last resort, but there is no punitive sanctions whereby somebody who's disqualified from driving or driving under the influence on a number of occasions or caught for, say, dangerous driving, or that somebody with previous convictions or a number of previous convictions for the same offences, there is no deterrent. They get into a car and they'll drive off, even from a courthouse. So there needs to be, I think, a stronger enforcement, especially from a court's point of view and a judicial point of view, in relation to people who are repeat offenders. I think we need to make examples of people, unfortunately, if we are to get the message through. But we need to also educate our young people. And as you know from the statistics, and everybody knows from statistics, the 16 to 25 year olds are primarily young males who are involved in serious road traffic accidents or fatalities, and it's between the hours of 12 at midnight and 4 a.m. in the morning. Those are the critical times, number one, and the people that are involved in these offences.
But the one thing I'll say, just to them, and I wonder what else we can do though, because I'm not sure if it's your stats or our stats, but since 2021, 50,000 drivers have been arrested while driving under the influence, right? Yeah. So that is enforcement on a grand scale. That's, you're heading towards Croke Park in terms of drunken drug driving. Young people are losing their friends. They're seeing firsthand the consequences of road traffic collisions. They're very sadly losing their friends, or they see their friends very seriously injured. They're seeing potentially their friends or the peer group being stopped for drink and drunk driving and being put off the road. And still that isn't enough to change behaviour to the level that we need to see a reduction in these figures. So, and I'm not saying let's give in. I'm just curious, what else can we do to enforce that message if
I think it's a combination of things, Greg. I think it's a combination of things. Apart from the legislation, the education, enforcement, we're not getting the message through to those people that we need to get the message through. And how do we do that? It doesn't matter how much you put on your Instagram or your YouTube or anything else, and you know you're trying to do everything that you can to enforce that. The belief in people that if you drive at excessive speeds, if you drive under the influence, something's going to happen. You know, that has fatal consequences for a lot of people, or serious consequences for a lot of people. Unless we can get that message through and keep giving that message time after time after time, unless we enforce that message, and we have to, but we also have at the same time to build up our enforcement of that message as well. If we don't do it in tandem on a continuous basis, then we are not making a real dent into reducing fatalities.
We need to stop doing that. We need to stop throwing money at the RSA, do we not? It was going to be spit focusing on licensing and all that kind of stuff. They're either doing very little or chucking money at influencers. There's an awful lot of money going into the RSA while the problem worsens. I think that's certainly an area that the government needs to look at, surely.
Yes, absolutely. Because I was listening to the CEO of RSA on prime time there one night, and they were talking about the issues in relation to the, how they, at one stage they're going to split the RSA up, but now it's come under the remit of the Department of Transport, I believe. And I don't think, you know, look at a lot of these state, semi-state agencies. They're grand. They have great ideas and policies and procedures and what they're going to do. But it's actually people on the ground. The enforcement side is very important. And if you don't have a buy-in from everybody, and I mean people who are driving on the roads every day, if you don't have a buy-in from the policing authority and everyone else, yeah. Okay. Then it's very hard to get that message through.
It is, Christy. Listen, thanks for the time, for your time. I appreciate it. Do you agree, disagree? 086 60 25,000. We're talking now about GP density across Ireland. And Donegal ranks kind of mid-table, but it doesn't tell the full picture here because of the rural nature of the county and the drive to a GP, but also the fact that we have higher ratios often of medical card holders, and that can change dynamics. But we'll tease it out now and probably take a national overview primarily with Deputy David Cullinan, who's Sinn Féin spokesperson on health. Good morning to you, David. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning to your listeners.
Right, so we are seeing a rapid growth in the population in this country. Counties like Donegal, certainly in terms of hosting Ukrainians and others, proportionately has seen a greater increase, you could argue. But in terms of general practice care, it's not keeping pace. And you've been looking, you sought these figures and have been looking through them for us, or for you, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, so the starting point is that I've been talking to a lot of GPs from across the state, but most especially, obviously, in my own constituency in Waterford. But I would have contact with GPs across the state, and they have been raising issues with me in relation to increased workload, pressures, full practices, full lists, not being able to take on new patients, particularly the GMS GPs, who obviously provide services to medical card holders and those on GP only cards as well. So the first problem is that, yes, the population has massively increased. So the data I got from the HSE looks at the increase in the number of GPs over a five-year period from 2020 to 2025. In that time period, the population has increased by almost 10%, but the number of GPs has only increased by about 6%. It's less in Donegal, it's just over 5%. And it means that the population growth is obviously not being matched with a corresponding growth in the number of GPs. And that's leading to real problems. So in the same data presented, the HSE say that almost 6,000 people have contacted their liaison office for the first half of this year. So that's only from January up to the end of June. And these are families seeking help because they have been unable to find a GP, to get a GP appointment, or to become registered with a GP.
So in other words, they cannot get more and more. Their local GP. They cannot get a local GP. The local GP says, look, we're at capacity, or this, that. So the 6,000 or close to 6,000, they only would contact the HSE when they are saying, look, we need care for ourselves or our children, and there is no local care available.
Well, that's essentially it. And there was a report last week from the Irish Council of General Practitioners, which actually looked at rural areas. And I know that's a problem in Donegal as well, where rural practices have particular problems. They have an ageing demographic of GPs. I know in some instances, GPs working into their 80s because they can't find replacements. We have GPs who then retire and they can't get replacements to take over their lists. It means people have to travel longer. It means people have to wait longer. So the human consequence of this can be an older person, for example, who cannot get an appointment with a doctor they've known for years. Very often families, as I said, are contacting practice after practice, trying to register their children, themselves and their families. And what GPs are saying is that continuity of care, which was always the bedrock of primary care, that you had a family GP, you would see that GP on a consistent basis. You would grow a relationship with them. They would know your history, your family history, and so on. But that relationship is unfortunately becoming much more difficult to maintain. And what's happening is when people ring a GP practice, very often they might see different GPs over a reasonable time period because the their main GP just may be busy or not able to see them. So there's a lot of problems. Capacity is the obvious issue. And unfortunately, GPs themselves are saying that the increased workload, the pressures of trying to deal with the list that they have, and now having to turn away people is obviously not where we want to be in terms of general practice.
No, we don't. But there is also a little bit of built-in discrimination, maybe you could describe it as, I don't know, in that there is a system in place whereby, and it can be a quite protracted system, whereby a GP can be obliged to take on a medical card patient. But if you've got a working family or a family of greater means, that doesn't apply to them. So the system seems a little bit skewed there.
Well, the vast majority of GPs in this state would have what's called a GMS contract. So at the moment, we have a blended system. So most GPs would treat private patients, but they would also see patients who obviously have medical cards or a GP visit card. So that blended system has worked reasonably well. And as I said, for decades, that relationship that people have with their family GP is really important because it is the first step. It's your first gate into the health service. And if you have that very strong connection with a GP over a long time period, obviously that's better for patients, it's better for GPs. So I'm not sure that discrimination exists. What does seem to be happening is that the number of non-GMS doctors is actually increasing. Mm. So that's the number of private doctors.
Yeah, no, we are seeing and that indeed, yeah. But unfortunately, that happens to be primarily in urban.
Bear in mind, Greg, 42% of the population have either a medical card or a GP visit card.
I get you.
And that's the area where we've only seen a 2% increase, so it's even worse than the overall figure.
Yeah, those private practices tend, from what I can see, to be in more urban areas. I get you. So the headline figure is very important, but I think there's sort of three, I think if we're genuinely going to fix this problem, there's sort of three subheadings, if not more. So dependent where you are, the raw head count per head of population, which is what we've been talking about, medical card panel sizes, which might you might see a greater proportion of those in counties like Donegal, and also a rural county like Donegal, but there are others, geographical access. You know, so I think if we're looking at this, we have to factor all of those things, because I would argue, David, there's not a one size fits all. It does have to be a nuanced approach if we are going to be looking at trying to make GP access, you know, more equitable and literally there.
Yeah, so I think that the first starting point is that we increase training places. So currently we train about 350 GP trainees every year. Unfortunately, not all of those will come into general practice. Many will leave the country. It's the same with nursing and dentistry. Some will go into other disciplines of medicine. Some may become junior doctors in hospitals. Some become locums. What's shifting as well in terms of a trend, and it's an obvious one and one that we should support, is that young trainee GPs want a better work-life balance. They don't want to be working 70 or 80 hours a week, and many of them don't want to come out and become entrepreneurs and essentially become business people, having to manage a practice, manage staff, and that's what they have to do. And that's why I have also called for the option of a public contract, a public GP contract, where you can have GPs working for the HSE, treating patients and not having to have that option of having to run a busy practice. That is an option for some. So for me, this is about choice. There's also issues about how we value GPs, and there are issues in rural communities. So we can see that that is a difficulty. If you live in a rural community, or if you work in a rural community as a GP, it's a big geographical area. You might find it difficult to get locum support. They have difficulty getting time off. It can be very often in an area where a higher age demographic, you have more complex care. So as you're saying there, it isn't a one size fits all. The minister has said that there is a review underway at the moment in relation to general practice. And I would hope that it would look at all of those issues. So obviously expanding training places, looking at greater incentives to attract more GPs to come in, trainees to come in and become GPs, particularly in the public system, but also in rural areas, and maybe pilot projects that can attract more trainees into rural areas. Mm. Look at the incentives, look at how we better value GPs, and then appreciate that work-life balance and greater flexibility is something that all employees want, and GPs are no different. So there's lots of challenges, at the moment, the headline figures, unfortunately, are that the population is expanding. The number of GPs is not keeping pace with that. And more people are contacting the HSE and indeed
well,
the local politicians looking for help and looking for support just to get access to a GP.
Deputy Callanan, thank you very much for your time. He's Sinn Féin spokesperson on health. And Jennifer Cara McNeill, the Minister for Health, as the Deputy just outlined, a strategic review of general practice is underway and should be completed later this year. So perhaps maybe it'll take on board some of what the opposition has to say. I think Minister Carol McNeill would be quite open to any positive suggestions. I don't know. I'm not her cheerleader. But hopefully she might include some of the recommendations from the opposition as well, too. A caller asks, has AI or Google reduced or increased the work of GPs, I wonder? Also, why are people being sent to casualty when GPs could sort them out, or do they not have the facilities or equipment? It's a tough one. You've asked a lot of questions there. I don't see how AI is reducing or increasing the workload of GPs, to be honest with you. And generally speaking, you know, the pressure in the ED is that people need to be admitted to hospital, so a lot of the people need to be there as well. But I also understand that, listen, when we get this in, when this injuries unit is opened, you know, where you go in there and someone's twisted their ankle, turned their knee, or they've got a pain heel there, you know, that will filter out a lot of people that don't need to be there. GPs that accept medical card services were sent large stacks of Ukrainian medical card forms, and these clinics had no choice but to accept these people as patients. I'm not really quite sure about that, but I presume as part of that deal that, you know, access to healthcare would have been a part of it. How big that is, I don't know. Interesting, just because a lot of people are mentioning Ukrainians today, which is understandable. But anyway, in the paper today, more than 1,500 Ukrainians will be affected when almost 90 hotels end accommodation contracts with the state between now and the end of October. A number of hotels across popular tourism destinations, including almost 20 accommodation centres in County Kerry, will now either return to the hospitality industry or may adopt another state contract for international protection. The government is winding down its contracts with commercial accommodation centres for beneficiaries of temporary protection who arrived in the Republic before March 2024. And there are hotels, and there's hotels in Letterkenny where part of the hotel would be for sort of tourism, regular work, and part of it is reserved for people availing of that. But anyway, it's been announced that Kate Barton and Brendan Tiny Vaughan are set to be presented with a Tip O'Neill Irish Diaspora Award at a gala ceremony on Friday the 25th of September at the beautiful Inishowen Gateway Hotel in Buncrana. Their prestigious Tip O'Neill Irish Diaspora Awards celebrate members of the global Irish family who have distinguished themselves in their respective fields while maintaining strong connections to Ireland and promoting Irish values and heritage around the world. Now, Kate Barton, congratulations to you, but I'm far more familiar with Brendan Tiny Vaughan, originally from Carrigal, but now an Englishman. He joins me in
Englishman.
I'm only joking.
I know you.
Congratulations, Brendan. Very well deserved. And as I was reading out the you know, the qualifying criteria for picking up this award, I mean, you hit every button there. And I'm delighted to see you get the recognition. I'm not sure how comfortable you are with it, but anyway, who cares? You've got it, and fair play to you.
I'm accepting this prestigious accolade on behalf of the people that have backed me since 2011. That's when I started the Donegal Hospice Calendar and the London Irish Vintage Day. And as you know yourself, you've been over several times. It's one of the biggest Irish days in the London calendar. And we'll try our best to keep it going. It's not easy at the moment trying to keep these things going.
Well, you're dealing with local authorities, local councils.
Oh, I'm telling you, the amount of hassle that we've had with them. You know, Maureen keeps saying to me, "Oh, be positive when you say anything." But the depression they carry on, they'll be at, you know.
Yeah, with terms and conditions and all that stuff. So back in 2011, is that when you started sort of fundraising in earnest?
Yes.
And it was off the back of your own personal loss, often is your beautiful mum.
My mother was in the hospice, you know, and she was in for, I think it was about 9.5 weeks. And do you know, this the first time I went to the hospice, and I'm sure everybody goes through that, it's, you're nervous going to a hospice and you think the worst. But when I went there the first time, it was just unbelievable. And the care and attention my mother got, and it was brilliant, you know. And I used to go out and about, I mean, and take photographs. I don't claim to be a photographer, but I get enough photographs ready right for to do the hospice calendar. And I wouldn't be the best now with a laptop. And I took up the laptop and managed to get it going. And it was Maureen got it going anyway. And showed her a few photographs. And this is like a John Baxter and Chrysler and different places around that I took photographs of. I prefer the old characters. And I says, I'm thinking of doing a calendar for the hospice. Oh, she says, that'd be a great idea. Yeah. So I started that, and with the support of, and these are the only two men I'm going to mention now because there's too many people that have backed me down the years to mention, and that's Tim Kelly and Helen Corbett up at the at Kelly's, and Seamus Quinn and Donegal Town and London as well. And without their backing and support of the Donegal Hospice Calendar, it wouldn't raise 240,000 to date, you know.
Which is a remarkable figure. And before we talk about that, did you have an interest in photography? Because anyone that sees you now will see you with your camera, and you'll take a picture with your big camera, and you'll take one for your phone with your phone. Did you have an interest in photography before the calendar?
Oh, long before.
Right,
because
so
I mean,
it was a perfect match. Then,
I mean, when I was in Boston in 1987, I had the camera there. I have the only team photograph that we had. When I played for Galway in Boston in 1987. And then when we were in Germany, we went down to the around Berlin at the camera. And then in Disneyland Paris from 91 to 92, a big Donegal contingent at Disneyland, especially from around Glencolum Kill and Carrick. And I had the camera there. And for argument's sake, I was up on the top of the highest cherry picker above the castle up on a cherry picker. At that time, you didn't have to wear a harness or nothing.
No.
Just go way up on that.
Risk it.
Good head for heights.
You'd need that.
What started me on photography was my mother. She gave me a wee box camera that Mita Spear and Kerry gave her. Mita gave her the camera, and then I would just go and try and take a photograph. A reel. I mean, we hadn't much money. And a reel of a photograph, maybe 24, and you'd print it, and you'd wait for maybe 2 weeks for them photographs to come back, and they weren't great, but it's all you had, you know. It was great to see them.
Yeah.
And from that, and the old fella too was a great man for taking you here and taking you there to get photographs. He never refused a photograph anywhere, and I took some photographs of him, but when you look back, I think I didn't take enough of him.
Yeah.
But I have some great photographs of him, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the other thing that you're very synonymous with is the London Irish Vintage Club and the annual Charity Vintage Day. Now, this in and of itself has raised £1 million, in excess of £1 million. And it's, you know, not just for Irish causes, which are incredibly important, but also causes in England, in Britain.
And London, because we work.
Yeah, and a lot of them have an Irish, that, you know, have an Irish connection as well, but not exclusively.
No. I mean, we supported the Kevin Bell Trust there, the Northern Air Ambulance, and different hospices throughout London. And we'll continue. Every year we try to support a hospice because the Irish are heavily involved and being looked after by the hospice.
But it's also groups that are there for, you know, maybe retired Irish people who find themselves now retired in London, and they don't have the work and they don't have the infrastructure, and there's loads of that going on. And that has, I mean, you know, even without the charity element to it, which is incredibly impressive, to have this Irish Day in the heart of London, whereby to all intents and purposes, you walk into that field and you could be in any Irish town in the country. It's a bizarre old thing.
Absolutely. And what I'm trying to get this year, if I can, is the Sam Maguire to the Vintage Day.
You'll finally
as well.
Get my old to turn up.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was one of the greatest occasions in a long time that Mayo won the Sam Maguire, and I'm delighted for them. Delighted.
People kind of like you to call them but don't want you to call them either. That's your reputation.
Oh, well.
Like, you know, if you ring, it's very rarely to see how you're getting on. You're looking for something.
Always, I and and the support. I'll give you an example, like Paul O'Donnell. We have two forklifts there from Flannery's and two drivers for the whole time because they're flat out. And Jay Coffey and give us four men to help put down the stages. Mitchison, Martin Masters, who's got connections in Kilmacrennan, gives us the bale supply, 4x3. MP Moran gives us the screws for the floor. You know, we get so much help. It's unbelievable. And there's too many to mention.
No, of course
you know,
not.
There's,
yeah, keep it.
There's so many people to mention.
Yeah, but just an example, I mean, was it last year or the year before that you did the tractor raffle and, you know, raised money? I think in that situation it was for two local families of young children benefited in that. But you do so much, I might have mixed them all up. But even just, like, moving that tractor around, whether it's from one village to another or one festival to another or from London to hear or what have you. You know, it's people that pick up the phone that end up helping you.
And
they don't ever look for credit.
No.
They don't ever look for praise. They just want to be part of something.
James Doherty is a prime example. Mm. I mean, he's helped Orla Neely there recently with her tractor. And James Doherty has never said no about taking a vehicle back. Last year, we had a car for the two children. And he took it here, took it there, you know, and it was brilliant. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, okay.
And then you had Dennis Ferry and Lee Gooch.
I do worry about those lads.
And Leslie.
I do worry about
Leslie O'Donnell. They're all away in the head, right? But you have to be.
Yeah, of course you do.
To do that, you know.
No, but you know what they do, and they're a perfect example. They're the two lads, and Lee as well, of course. They just say, right, there's something we can make a difference about and just get involved, you know. And
without that help, you can't do it. I mean, we have something else in the coming up as well. And as for, well, I won't talk too much about it because it's in the early stages, for Little Blue Heroes in County Mayo and Donegal, because a Mayo man wanted to be a sponsored and Donegal man wanted to be Charlie McCarron, Mark Maloney, Mayo. So it's it's in the process and it will be announced within the next month or so, you know.
What about yourself now? You split your time between London and Donegal, and you're like so many Irish that went to work over there.
Yeah.
You know, your roots, you start planting roots, don't you? And then there's family connections and generational stuff and all that type. And then you get to the age, maybe you want to spend a bit more time in Donegal now. I know you're still working, don't get me wrong. Yeah. And it becomes more complicated. There's so many men and women in that situation. But the one thing I noticed from the London Vintage Show is the lads often have this draw back home.
Always.
But they have family now that have planted themselves over there. Mm-hmm. And it's this pull, you know, no, I want to go home, but I can't leave.
Well, I think I'm the opposite way now because I want to go back for good. Hopefully next year, because
but you don't think you said that to me a couple of years ago, though.
But I'm into my 45th year now away from home, and it's just time. And I'm not able to do what I used to do. I'm a shuttering donkey, as I call it.
What is that? What do you do over there?
Shuttering carpenter,
right.
In layman's terms, there is a steel structure, with mesh, then you have a box in layman's terms,
and then you pull concrete,
then you put bolts through it, make sure it doesn't bust, and fill it with concrete, strike it off, and that's a column or a wall or whatever.
Yeah, I get you.
You know? Mm. And I'm on a job at the moment in Paddington where there's a Milford man who's the main man on the job, Christy Galler from Milford. And I have to thank him for a lot of help as well. There's so many cogs in the London circle.
No, there is. Well, listen, me and you are going to sit down for a podcast soon and we might release it around the time of this great award. So we'll dig into all of that and you'll be able to have more time. The gala ceremonies on Friday the 25th of September, as I mentioned. Looking forward to that?
I am looking forward.
Are you glad rags on? You'll have to leave the camera down now.
No, well, hell. I mean, the camera will be there and Clive Wasson will be snapping away there, but Clive is a photographer. I'm just
a fluter.
I'm only a pretend.
You're a hash.
I'm rough and ready.
No, listen, you're doing yourself a disservice. The calendar's there. It's you've a great eye for what would make a great picture, which is, you know, being a beat up old tractor and an old man or whatever it might
That's
be.
It.
You know, it's archiving. You're a great archivist. We've got a number of great archivists, archivists or whatever you call them in this county.
Great photographers. Yeah. Like you've got Tony Nee that goes around taking photographs. You have Thomas Galler, Evan Logan that takes photographs. You know, Declan Doherty, and I've Geraldine Deverby's at all the games as well. Mm. And do you know, without them recording,
but it's the festivals as well.
Sir Colin Tribune,
Siobhan McGowan's down in South Donegal. I'm going to give Siobhan, my old neighbour,
everybody a shout out. Yeah. Because without them,
Breed in the West, what's it?
Breed, another great. She covers the Mary from Dunloe and all them.
She hasn't seen the pictures she took of me yet, though.
Yeah.
So
she probably broke the camera.
Thinking, do you know why? I was standing beside Daniel O'Donnell.
Oh, you know. But no, it's look, the main person behind this, and she doesn't want any recognition as Maureen.
Yeah.
Without her and without her help and the kids, Connell and Miva. And I couldn't do all this.
Why is Maureen so important?
Because she keeps me calm, you know.
Which is no mean feat.
It's no mean feat because I'm partial to an odd-out swear word, you know.
I heard that, all right.
I don't know. But it's the only times I don't swear is when I'm Highland Radio and sleeping.
Thank God. I am sitting here bricking it, waiting for you to let one sleep.
No, that, and do you know this, hey? You may talk about all the rest of the things, but you know the main people that has helped me out down the years, and it's Highland Radio, yourself, and even Sean Doherty in previous years, and the CEO upstairs that's looking around him up there. He's drinking away at coffee.
Oh, no, I can see him out there.
He's sitting out there, is
he? He's standing out there waiting for you to mention
and
him.
The one main woman herself, Karen Orr, you know, Lee Gooch. You know, all them people have helped this journey along, and you are part of that award as much as...
Well, you'll be glad to hear that I've never attended the Tip O'Neill Irish Diaspora Awards, but I'll tell you, I'm clearing the 25th of September. I'm going.
Oh, good man yourself. Eh? That'd be great.
If there's an opportunity to take a hand at you, I'm going to be there. So you can thank me from the stage.
Oh, that's great. No, I'm thanking everybody here today because of off Highland Radio. And you were talking on the way up about community. Highland Radio reach out to lots of communities all over the world. I mean, for example, we were in Philadelphia there in March, and that was a great... I don't like the word diaspora. It sounds...
No,
like
but you know what? I'm not...
Is there another word they could use?
Yeah, I'm not a massive fan of the diaspora word myself either.
Neither is Tony McFadden, and I agree with him, former chairman.
I understand... that you have to have a word to catch it at all, and it just happens to be that word.
Yeah.
But it's never really...
Never.
Like, I could never... So if I'm talking about you, I would have to talk about you as a member of the diaspora community.
Aye.
And it's like, well, where's the Irish in that, or where's the story behind that?
Like,
but look, it's a word. It's
like
a word.
An old deadly disease.
Aye.
But no...
Get a cream for it.
I was just talking about Highland, and... You got the people in Boston that listen to Highland Radio, and you got the people in Philadelphia, New York, and us in London who listen to Highland Radio, and we're very thankful for Highland Radio coming over to the Vantage Day and promoting our...
You know what's lovely about that is meeting people over there that, I mean, they come home, but they haven't been home for ages.
Aye.
And they come up to you and chat to you as if they were in Milford or Ardrah. Aye. They're as in contact with Highland and what we'd be talking about as anything. It's astonishing. I love that connection over there.
And they're talking to you.
And everywhere.
They're talking to you as if the...
Well, it's their local radio station in London. It's their local radio station in London. It's fantastic.
Brilliant.
I love it. But all right, go on.
Yeah, I'd like to thank everybody that helps us. That's it.
Yeah, well,
all the way
to you.
Down the line.
You know, you get stuff done. That's the thing about Brendan Tiny Vaughan, and you've done so much. And, you know, we've talked about the headlines about the Donegal Hospice calendar, which is astonishing. €250,000 almost. Well over €1 million raised through the charity Vintage Day. But there's an awful lot in between all of that.
There's other bits and pieces. I couldn't tell you.
But people listening will know. Because they will have been affected. They'll have seen it in their own community. We'll have a longer chat into the future, and I'm going to look forward to that. But we just wanted to say congratulations to you on being a recipient of this year's Tip O'Neill Irish Diaspora Award. And you're going to collect that award on Friday, the 25th of September, at the Inishon Gateway Hotel in Buncrana. What does coming home to Donegal, retirement life, what do you do? You're not going to travel, are you?
I'm just going out and snap away. Hey, I was telling her, where
get yourself a wee boat.
I go into there and you get look at the worst camper van that's ever. And I sent a photograph to Maureen. Then I said, Maureen, that's a nice wee camper van there. There might be even a toilet in it. She says, I'm not going in a camper van.
I think she needs to get out now while she can. But do you know what? Convince her. Take her out and once she'll love it.
That's my... hopefully now we will get a camper van.
That's lovely, brilliant That'd stuff. And do you know the funny thing is, and I don't mean this in any way funny, you could get a camper van and never leave Donegal.
That's it.
You literally Donegal would never just, have to leave Donegal.
So you couldn't get finer. You
know, from Bundoran to Malin and everywhere in
Malin,
between.
Malin, right over to Glencolum Kill, yeah. Calling to Margaret Rose Cunningham there in the folk village. You couldn't get a better welcome. All of Donegal as a great welcome.
All right, listen, we could talk, you know, we could talk for hours, Brendan. Listen, congratulations. Very, very well deserved. And to a man and woman listening, I'm sure they'd agree. And congratulations to Kate Barton as well, who will speak closer to the time. But obviously, we've got very strong connections with Brendan and all the work that he does. And it's great. Fair play. Good to see a Carrick Art man getting a bit of recognition.
Thank you to Highland Radio for all your coverage over the years. Thank you very much.
Now, in 2026, would you believe that a rape victim was in court, and in court she was asked, was she wearing underwear when she was attacked? A dress she was worn or had been wearing was also shown at the trial. This has been described by many as blatant victim blaming and a form of public humiliation. Kira Mangan is chief executive of Beyond Surviving. Kira, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me this morning.
There has to be a better way, doesn't there?
Yeah, it's... You'd think that we were 40 years ago, but this is still happening in 2026. Completely shocking. Like you said, pure public humiliation of the victim, as if going on the witness stand isn't hard enough. Yeah, just... totally inappropriate.
Because the only, I can imagine, I'm not privy with the entire trial, but I presume the only way this would be brought in was to suggest that in some way she was egging someone on or prepping for something or whatever it might be. And I hate to say that because it almost sounds like I'm compounding it, but I haven't mentioned the person's name nor the trial. But what other reason might this type of a defence be employed?
Well, that's what they're doing, though, aren't they? They're implying and discrediting the victim. You know, displaying or showing or using a victim's underwear in a trial, like it's so backwards. Like, it's just not what we do in this day and age. I just can't understand how that's just still acceptable.
We are in this situation in that part of the problem here is that this type of coverage might deter other people from engaging with the judicial system. And the truth is very few cases actually end up going before the court. So I don't want to compound that, if you know what I mean, nor neither do you, because that would be counterintuitive. But the only way really this can be resolved is... what do you call on the better judgment of the defence, or is there some provision needed to prevent this type of thing happening? Where's the landing spot here, I wonder?
Clear guidelines on what is appropriate, what is victim blaming, what is used to simply discredit the victim, to blame the victim, what is inappropriate and what is appropriate. I mean, it's just basic principles. The justice system is historically, you know, the most unwilling institution to evolve or change or learn as they go along. We're constantly fighting for basic, in many instances, just common sense. You know, it's just not what should be happening in 2026. And the victim herself, you know, on the stand, she said that experience for her felt like an out-of-body experience. And it can happen to anyone because, I mean, everybody wears underwear. So everyone is at risk if they're going on the stand for that to happen. You know, it just makes zero sense.
Does this sort of feed into the continued existence of this patriarchy, that, in other words, the system is designed to ensure men have the power and the privilege?
I don't know, like, if that's what it's about. I think this is just simply to try and discredit the victim.
No, I got you.
Yes, of course, at the heart of sexual violence and domestic abuse, yes, it's all rooted in power and control over the victim. But in this particular case, I suppose, within the system or the trial, it's no other than just victim blaming, you know, outdated myths about sexual violence. What you're wearing, whether it's a top or it's underwear, none of those are consent, and they have no relevance at all as to whether an encounter was consensual or not. And it's simply just public humiliation of someone who's already going through the most daunting experience that one can ever go through, and that's to sit on that stand. And as she said, it felt like a complete out-of-body experience for her, and she's right.
Yeah, what I don't understand as to why it's even admissible in this day and age is because of our, like, so, you know, someone could literally be about to engage consensually in a sexual act, and they could at that point then say, actually, no. And if the mm-hmm. person were to continue, that would be rape or a sexual assault. So I don't understand how clothing is relevant anymore when we have that mm-hmm. understanding of what consent is and what no means, etc. As well, not to mention, this is actually was a statutory rape case. The victim was underage. But do you get where I'm coming from? Like, it should be irrelevant, because at any point, if someone doesn't want to engage in an activity, it doesn't matter what they're wearing or if they're wearing nothing.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much work going on in society around consent, and we're learning about it. It's in schools. People are understanding now what it is. No means no, and you know, you can revoke it if it started off consensually. But, you know, some rules apply within society, and then within a trial, you can see how none of those rules, you know, come into play. Like, it's just a completely different ball game in the courts versus outside. Yes, of course, it's court of law, and they obviously understand consent and everything, but we don't, you know, how it's just such a mismatch between what we're doing in society and learning and evolving, and then, you know, encouraging victims to go to court. And, you know, they're seeing, you know, the changes in society and how it is getting better. I know it seems like it's getting worse, but it is getting better. And then once you go into that system and that court process, then you're like 40 years behind the rest of the country, you know? So it's it's never evolving. It's never changing. And this will, you know, it's a headline today, it's a headline tomorrow, but, you know, what is the justice system going to do to not have this happen again? It happened before, and it made, you know, national headlines for many, many weeks because people were appalled. And here we are again, again. And when will we be there again? Do you know what I mean?
I get you.
When is it going to change?
That's why these types of conversations are important. Kira, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it. Kira Mangan, Chief Executive of Beyond Surviving. Well done, Tiny. Well deserved, says Rose. Congratulations to Brendan Tiny Vaughan, his wife Maureen, and his children, and all who support him, a most worthy recipient of this most prestigious award, a fitting accolade for a man who truly deserves to be acknowledged for what he has done and the way he's helped people in Donegal, Ireland, and Irish people abroad through his charity, fundraising work, and his kindness. And that comes in from Father John Joe Duffy. Well done, Brendan. A well-deserved award. We're delighted for you from all in the Chrysler Community Association. And more and more of those coming in as we go. GPs are now using AI and Google to help with diagnosis, Greg, all the time. Alternatively, ordinary unqualified people are self-diagnosing using them and can believe they know better than the doctor does. They think they know what's wrong with them and what they need to cure or heal the illness or injury. Rang a private GP yesterday to get a medical sign for a driving license because I couldn't get an appointment with my own GP until next week. The fee with the private GP was €200. My own GP was 60. Well, see, this is where you could end up with a two-tier, GP health service. You get it signed. Did you pay the 200? I suspect you might have. Or do you wait and save €140? It's a tough one, isn't it? Morning, Greg. Listening to your guest speaker, it makes perfect sense to close our borders to more people coming into this country when we don't have enough doctors, hospital places, home care for older people, etc. Thank you. I get where you're coming from, but 40% minimum of staff at Letterkenny University Hospital came through those borders. And that would be some cherry picking, wouldn't it? But anyway, listen. In relation to the dangers of our roads, focus on getting rid of drugs and there'll be less people killed. I hear where you're coming from. It's not just that, though. It's drink as well. It's speeding. It's careless driving. It's taking its eye off the road and all that type of stuff. You know, and listen, there's in terms of road traffic collisions, we had incident at the weekend and the guards were fantastic in relation to that. And companies like, you know, just down from us here, JD, you know, when you have to call them and they're there in a shot, there's an awful lot of people for more minor stuff that are there and make things as less stressful as they possibly could be. I'm going to finish with a request because it's a special couple and I didn't get to it at 10. Happy wedding anniversary to Margaret and Edward Connolly in Ballandrate. From your favourite son, Eddie, Louise, Hannah, Jay, Charlie and Heidi, Eddie. Are you? Okay. Listen, that's it where we leave it today. Have a great day, everyone.